Good afternoon. So, what are we here for again? Yes. So I've offered you the practice of Samatha Vipassana. It's the practice of insight wisdom. And it's the best thing that I have to offer you. And so take it, combine it with the path of knowledge, study, and analysis. The path of the heart, selfless service. The path of devotion. In whatever proportions are just right for you. But don't neglect any parts of it. And use that, you use those practices together to bring yourself to that awakening that you are much, much closer to than you realize. You're all very close here. Because each of you is a manifestation of ultimate truth. And ultimate truth is staring you in the face at every moment. And so it's just, you are so close. You just need that to draw aside that veil of obscuration that's separating you from realization. And these are the tools that will help you to do that. In that process, you will come to the place of ultimate surrender of your attachment to your illusions. And you are so attached to your illusions. But as you begin to have inside experiences, as in various ways your practices begin to reveal the truth to you more and more. The important thing, the most important thing that's going to be happening as a result of that process isn't in the level of your conscious awareness. It's in the deep part of your mind from which your worldview arises. And what happens at some point as these insights and these realizations of the way things really are begin to sink into that level, that part of your mind that generates your view of reality is trying to incorporate this in. And the old ways stop working. The idea of who and what you are, the ego self, begins no longer to be, what you might say, logically sustainable by the part of your mind that is trying to interpret your ongoing experience. And you'll know that's happening when consciously certain kinds of emotions begin to arise. When, at the deepest level of your mind, it hasn't yet quite been able to come up with a new basis for synthesizing your experience that encompasses this realization of the emptiness of things and the emptiness of yourself. It can be very emotionally painful. Saint John of the Cross described it as a dark night of the soul. And a much more modern Christian saint, well, she hasn't been saint, sanctified, but Bernadette Roberts, who's described in detail the Christian experience of awakening, not just to the first stage of awakening, but also to the final stage of awakening. But she describes that first stage for herself in the way that she said, for all my life, God was always there. I could always find God, find that support. And then there came the day when she looked and God was no longer there. And no matter how hard she tried, that which she had relied on all of her life as her support, this continual presence of God, was gone. And this was her dark night. Until she realized God was not gone and had never been gone. What was gone was the self by which she had known God. And once she realized that, of course, it was wonderful. And that's the sort of thing that's the sort of transition that's involved in this process. It can happen fairly quickly, or it can happen very slowly, and it can be painful. You can go through this experience in a matter of hours, but for some people it's spread over weeks and months and even years, this dark night. And when that happens, a person finds that the experience that their life loses all meanings, they feel like they don't know what to do. There's this emptiness, but it's literally a feeling of emptiness, but it's a reflection of their mind trying to incorporate the understanding of emptiness, and emptiness as applied in particular to the self. And it can give rise to despair, confusion, depression, desperation, fear, misery, a lot of disgust with the world, an inability to see the beauty and magnificence and wonder of this mind-created world. Whether it happens that way or whether it's something that you go through fairly quickly depends on several factors. The most important ones of which is if your mind is prepared in such a way that is imbued with joy, which I'll explain to you a little bit more what that is, tranquility and equanimity, then in this tradition that's described as this is the process of insight, and that and the joy, tranquility, and equanimity of samatha lubricate the process of insight so that it goes smoothly and quickly and relatively painlessly. And so that's one very important factor. For a practice that does not develop the joy and the tranquility and the equanimity of samatha, then when you come to the stage of insight, it can be very, very painful and very disturbing. In the Buddhist tradition, there are described the 16 stages of insight. And in the middle of them are what are called the knowledges of suffering. They are the knowledge of terror, the knowledge of misery, the knowledge of disgust, and the knowledge of the basically the surrender to the need for deliverance, need you come to this place of you just have to surrender yourself. It's the only hope. And so those are pretty much an inevitable part of the process. And as I say, it can happen quickly in a brief period of time, or without the lubricating moisture of joy and tranquility and equanimity, it can be spread over a long period of time and be quite painful. There is another aspect to this. What's happening beneath the surface is that your mind is trying to incorporate a completely new way of viewing reality that doesn't include the idea that the ego self is the self. There's still, this is a mind that still has and will continue to have what I refer to as the inherent sense of self. But the ego construct, the constructed self, the personality self, which all of your life has been what the mind has understood to be the self, is obviously not that self anymore. And the mind's trying to adapt to that, and that's where the fear and the misery and the disgust are coming from. So another factor that plays into what kind of dark night and how long and how dark it is for you is how your insight has progressed. If the more understanding in the more different ways along the path that you have been able to incorporate of the emptiness of yourself, the less painful this is. Because that part of your mind's already done a lot of preliminary work. It's already let go of a lot of the attachments. And that makes it much, much easier. But if you arrive at this point where these insights, the full impact of these insights is coming, and no part of your mind has ever yet tried to deal with and tried to incorporate the non-reality of this personal self, then, as you can see, it's going to be far more traumatic. Make sense to you? Mm-hmm. Yes. And so, these are factors, this is a factor that you don't necessarily have a lot of control over, but one that you can intentionally practice and study in a way to work towards. You can make it a point from this day forward to try to understand in as many different ways as you can the meaning of the idea of emptiness of self. And the more you do that, and if you pay attention in your meditation to the periods that you have where there is no self, if you're doing walking meditation and the walking is only the walking, and you realize that, there's nobody doing the walking. There's not even anybody seeing the walking. There's just the walking. When you have those kinds of experiences, or when you're sitting in meditation following the breath, and you realize there's no self, there's just this process. There's the watcher, and there's the breath, but there's no one there behind this, doing this, in the role of the doer and the perceiver. It's just unfolding. Those experiences will be there, and make a point to notice them, because they're going to prepare your mind for this transition when the mind has to give up its attachment to the self. And also, whatever path you follow, the more you can do this meditation practice that brings about samatha. If you can get to the place of the arising of joy, and yes, I still have to tell you what joy is. The arising of joy and the maturation of joy into tranquility, and then the equanimity that comes out of that tranquility, you're going to make this whole process so much, so much easier and better for yourself. I'll tell you what joy is. Joy is a state of mind, a mental state. Maybe state of mind isn't the best way to put it. Mental state. It is a global condition of the mind. And when your mind is in a state of joy, of all the different things that your attention could go to and that could register in your consciousness, a mind that's in a state of joy tends to see the beautiful, the pleasant, the magnificent, the wonderful, the good, the wholesome. And, of course, all of the other kinds of things are there, but there's a certain selectivity of a joyful mind to see that kind of thing. Another property of the mental state of joy is that in terms of the feeling that arises in response to any experience, remember, every experience produces a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, on sort of a spectrum. Joy shifts where that perception happens. So something that might otherwise have been perceived as quite unpleasant is perceived as mildly unpleasant. Something that would have been perceived as mildly unpleasant is perceived as neutral. Something perceived as mildly pleasant is just absolutely fabulous. Even in the state of joy, when it's strong, something as simple as the breath itself can be the most incredibly exciting, enjoyable, wonderful thing. Very ordinary things that would otherwise be neutral are experienced as pleasure. So joy shifts the feeling tone of experience in the positive direction, the result of which is joy is accompanied by strong pleasure. The feeling of, in terms of pleasantness, unpleasantness, and neutral, everything shifted in the direction of pleasantness. The third quality of the mental state of joy is when the mind takes in a particular perception and processes it, how it processes it. And the simplest way to put it is that it sees the glass as half full, not as half empty. It perceives everything from a more positive perspective. This is the way a mind behaves that is in the mental state of joy. And the opposite of that is a mind that is in the mental state of grief or depression. It's the precise opposite. And if you think about that, we'll go through the same three things. A mind that is in a state of sadness or grief or depression. The eyes look out and they see the ugly, the broken, the damaged, right? No matter what you experience, something that ordinarily would taste good just has no taste at all. Everything is shifted towards the unpleasant, right? And there is no way you can see that glass is half full. That damn thing's half empty if anybody can see. Right? That's what I mean by mental state. The mental state of joy. And when you understand it as a mental state, automatically accompanied by happiness. Mental pleasure is happiness. And there will be physical pleasure as well. Then I think you can see the value and importance of it. Joy is associated with energy. When you experience it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking. When you experience it in meditation, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about because it's very strong. But I'll give you some familiar examples. Picture a child who finds out that they're getting, as a birthday present, something that they all wanted so badly. And it's like they're bouncing up in the sun, right? So filled with that. Or a person who, they've fallen in love with somebody and they find out that that person feels the same way they do. That is joy. They're elevated. The world is so beautiful. Everything's wonderful. Right? Yeah. So a trout just ran over my foot. Wow. I haven't got time to worry about things like that. Yeah. That's joy. The other thing is, if you think about it, when there's a state of joy, and it's very strong, I have a feeling your hair stands on end. Shivers run up and down your spine. Right? Chills and vibrations and all kinds of stuff. These are all things that you will experience in meditative joy, but even more strongly than in these ordinary circumstances where the joy is actually coming from the satisfaction of desire. Right? So if you can meditate to the point that joy begins to arise, this is going to powerfully help you in the ongoing process towards your awakening, in many ways. It's going to empower you in the meditation itself, but it's also going to be enormously helpful in passing through the difficult stages. A mind in that state is not going to be so vulnerable to the dark night. The energy of joy is very strong, so strong that it becomes disturbing. And at some point, you'll actually become, it will become very tiresome. But it also begins, the intensity subsides and a tranquility develops. And as the tranquility comes in, actually all of the energy is still there, but it's now moving in such a, it's flowing so smoothly that it's not like this anymore. You know, it's got a placidness to it. It's like a very small amount of water in a mountain stream, you know, is turbulent and white and frothy and tumbling and everything else. And then there's a point in the Ganges River where it's almost a mile wide and it looks like it's completely still. But there are literally millions of gallons of water flowing past every minute, right? It's that kind of thing. The energy becomes very slow and smooth, and that's the tranquility. The joy is still there. The mind is in a state of joy. The pleasure is still there, the pleasure that comes from joy. But that energetic intensity has become tranquility. And then there is equanimity. The equanimity that comes from this joy and pleasure being internally generated. Okay? So, depending on which combination of these practices you pursue, you may or may not follow the Samatha Vipassana path as far as the arising of joy and the maturing of joy into tranquility and the arising of equanimity. But it will be to your advantage to do so if you can, but it's not necessary. Okay? So that's where it fits in to the whole thing. The insight that's going to lead to awakening, your progress through all of these 10 stages is going to be creating the causes and conditions for insight to arise, for realizations to arise spontaneously. The other practices that you engage in are going to contribute to this very strongly in different ways. And so it all works together. When the insights begin to accumulate, when the deep transformations start to take place in your mind, depending on how you've worked with the insights that have arisen, and depending on the joy and the tranquility and equanimity that you've generated, you're going to go through some version, brief and mild, or drawn out and severe, of this dark night. But then it's going to culminate in a particular event. This is going to be the total, final surrender of the mind's attachment to the perception of self as a perception of the ego self as real. As a matter of fact, what the mind is giving up in this moment is even more than that. It's even giving up the inherent sense of being a separate self, although that's going to snap back again after this experience is over with. But the mind has to let go of that as well. What that feels like. Picture yourself standing on the brink of a precipice that you cannot see the bottom of. And someone you have really trusted is telling you, if you step off, you'll fly. And you're looking down. And as you look down, but if you take the step, what happens in that moment when you surrender and take the step, right? That's what has to happen next. And you can always step back from the precipice. You may not take the step. But if you don't, do it next time. If you step back, you're just stepping back into the dark night, right? So, and don't underestimate the difficulty of this step when it comes. How many of you have seen the movie Saving Private Ryan? Most of you. Some of you have not. You may or may not remember a scene where there's an American soldier struggling hand to hand with a German soldier who seems to be stronger. He ends up, the American is laying on his back, the German is above him, and he's holding a knife right over his shoulder, or right over his heart, or the heart of the person. And they're still in this moment of tense struggle, resistance. And the German says, like you would to a child that you're trying to calm, shh. And it's that kind of surrender. So, what's on the other side of this is more wonderful and glorious than anything that you could ever imagine, in a way that's completely different than anything you could ever imagine. But don't be fooled. It's not an easy transition necessarily. You have to prepare yourself for it. It is like dying. And not only that, it's only the beginning. You will do this repeatedly, but it will get much, much easier. It's never as difficult as the first time. So that's the bad news. But you can do it. And you'll be very glad you did. Yes?
Somebody else talked about enlightenment, and he experienced many times things like temptation and monsters and some of the things that come at you that are not real but illusory, but you don't know that, and you have to fight them. Does that happen in your perspective too?
That will happen depending on the person, their background, their conditioning. yes. If that's the way you conceive of it, as being a struggle against demons and monsters, then that's how it will play out in your mind. The Buddha conceived of it as a struggle with Mara. And Mara came, Mara's daughters came attempting to tempt him away from the path. Mara, through his criticism and his belittling, tried to cause the Buddha to give up his quest. Mara tried to say, what right do you think you have to do this? And he said, the earth itself testifies to my right to do this. Mara sent armies of demons that the Buddha had to withstand. And so these are all different ways that a person's mind may play out this drama. But what it comes down to, in its simplest terms, however you experience it, is your mind is dying to itself. And let me remind you of something. If what I've just told you sounds scary and hard, it's going to happen to every one of you anyway. You're all going to die. Better that you do it this way. Right? It's not something that you can avoid. And maybe that's something to think of when you find yourself standing on the brink of that metaphorical precipice. I cannot step back from this forever. Right? So I might as well take the step now and see if I really can fly. Jeff?
That famous phrase and gesture lift the earth. The famous phrase and gesture of the Buddha's let the earth bear witness.
Yeah.
Could you speak about that? What exactly does that mean? What is he talking about?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of ways that you could interpret that. Different people could. But to me, if that were the way I experienced it, what it would be, Mara is the part of my mind that is telling me that I can't do this. I don't have the right to do this. I don't have the ability to do this. That it's not possible to do this. That this can't even be done. That even sitting here thinking I can do this is because I'm gullible and been sucked in by, some silly myths and stories. That Mara is that part of the mind that challenges it in every way that you can. That it can, that this can really happen. And touching the earth is that part of your mind that has that certainty that's come from all of the struggle, all the way along, that this is not true, that it's false. And so may this solidity of my experience and of my struggles and my effort bear witness to that part of my mind that doubts that this can happen. That not only can it, but it is going to. That's how I would do it, right? But somebody else would probably come up with a much more poetic and beautiful version of it than I can. Yeah?
When you talk about the dark side, or whatever word you used, depression, or all the lousy stuff of the world, and stuff is really getting to you and stuff, is it worse than when I first came to Buddhism? That's why I came, because I was on the dark side. And I'm wondering if it's the same type of dark side like that, or is that and that was like dabbling in Buddhism, coming, not real strong, and then somebody said to me, the only way I can put it is the way they said it, pardon my language, either shit or get off the pot, one of them, and I dove my feet in, because I was like standing on that spot, so I'm just wondering if it's worse than, the things that could bring you to find a spiritual path. Or what it might be.
It's actually, it's not worse in the sense that when that feeling of meaninglessness and hopelessness and despair arises, as an emotion. It's arising in a mind that already has a kind of wisdom that a person in a state of ordinary depression doesn't have. The emotion itself is exactly the same, but it's not an emotion that's arising out of getting locked into a pattern of thought that gets reinforced over and over again. It's different. It's different from ordinary depression in the way it happens, and it happening in a different kind of mind. But the emotion itself, the feeling of meaninglessness. Well, and also I should point out to you that, as I said, that there's a variety of degrees of intensity that a person might experience this. Yeah. So it could be that for one person it's appropriate to use the word despair, right? And if that's what you're feeling, the emotion itself is exactly that same despair that you might have felt in other circumstances. Because basically what's happening is that there's a part of your mind that on both occasions, when it was activated, flooded the mind with a feeling of despair. And so there's no difference between the two in that regard. But also, not everyone necessarily is going to experience that kind of despair. As I say, you can move through it very quickly, and it cannot be very severe. There's one description of the knowledge of fear in the Visuddhimagga, which points this out. It says the experience of fear does not need to be that of fear itself, but rather the knowledge of fear that a person would know, for example, I can't remember the examples, but things like if you saw a pot of boiling oil and you know what would happen if you put your hand in it, you know, or if you saw a bush of knives and you know what would happen if you fell into it, sort of thing. So you don't necessarily have to become immersed in it. It can be just that, just the knowledge of, right? So it can happen over a huge range, depending on how you prepared yourself. But whatever does arise, as far as an emotion goes, it's exactly the same emotion coming from exactly the same place that has been there in other experiences in your life. It's just coming from a different cause. And in this case, the cause is that there is a part of your mind that is having to accept essentially its own death. Okay. And when you surrender to it, when it happens in a slower process, there comes the knowledge of the desire for deliverance. And it's coming from a place of, you've moved from a sense of hopelessness to a sense of resignation. You're approaching the point of surrender. There's the resignation that there is no alternative but to go forward. And you surrender to that. And that leads to a shift in the mind. And when that shift in the mind happens, then there is powerful equanimity. And there's this totally equanimous state of observing what is as what is. And that's what precedes the moment of complete surrender. And what follows that is after the attainment to the path is the fruition, which is a powerfully blissful experience. That's the flying part. Right? Yeah. So you can be the sort that runs up to the edge of the cliff and says, Oh my God, I hope this isn't a mistake. Or you can sit on the edge and dither and worry and scratch your head and start to go back and say, no, I don't know. You can do it either way. Yeah.
Is it possible to have achieved a direct perception of emptiness in a prior incarnation and not remember it in the current incarnation?
Leaving aside the terminology of prior incarnations and things like that, it is possible to have an experience of emptiness and not know it. But having had that experience, it will have had some effect. It may not have led you to surrender your attachment to personality view. If the you sitting there today still has attachment to personality view, it doesn't really matter how many times you've experienced emptiness.
Say that again.
What are the precursor insights that trigger the dark night of the soul?
Okay, well, they are described as the classic insights into the three characteristics. Impermanence, emptiness, non-self, depending on how you want to break those down, are the first two. And the third is the characteristic of suffering, that clinging attachment to these in any form is suffering. Then on the other hand, in the Visuddhimagga, there's a long list of 18 individual insights, which actually are all ultimately reducible to these three variations on them in different forms.
Impermanence, non-self of all phenomena, or of you?
Impermanence, emptiness, and no self. Depending on, you see, in the Pali Sutras, the Buddha speaks of the characteristics as being impermanence, no self, and suffering. Mm-hmm. Right? But if you look at what emptiness is, impermanence is the realization that there are no things, there is only flux. And that is actually the same thing as emptiness. Impermanence is really emptiness. It's emptiness seen from a particular perspective. And the same thing is true of no self. No self is the emptiness of self. So impermanence can be translated into the vernacular of emptiness as being the realization of the emptiness of phenomena and the emptiness of self. But whichever set of terminologies you use, the third characteristic is the suffering that comes from clinging to that which is impermanent and empty for the sake of that which is impermanent and empty.
How do you distinguish between the flux, you know, the constantly change, that changing energetic flux out of which we make a object or a fixed idea, the, you know, freeze frame thing, and the unchanging Buddha nature? What's the difference between those?
Very good question. Yeah. What's the difference between the perception of impermanence as flux and the unborn, unchanging, unceasing nature of the Buddha nature of suchness, of ultimate reality? Very good question. The insight into impermanence is still a perception. Okay, the flux you perceive is not ultimate reality. What you are perceiving is the non-reality of thingness.
Is that the same as dependent origination?
It's very much connected to dependent origination, but it's not the same thing. Dependent origination is describing how our perception of self and reality comes into being over and over again, and how we generate the karma that perpetuates this. But when, if we talk about insight into impermanence, we're talking about a kind of experience you have in which one part of the illusion has been stripped away, the illusion of thingness. And you see that there are no things, there is only process. But the fact is that process itself is still a mental formation. It's not the ultimate reality. But you have, but you've stripped away one layer of illusion, that the mind is no longer making process into things and imputing specific natures to different things. So. And that, by the way, is the nature of all of the insights that precede the culminating insight, is that they aren't, you know, they aren't an experience yet that is devoid of fabrications. There may be fewer fabrications, different kinds of fabrications. There is the falling away of the ordinary fabrications that keep us trapped. And so each insight experience helps us to penetrate by revealing that some aspect of the way we perceive things is not the way it appears to be, right? But all of this culminates in the cessation of mental formations, the complete cessation of the process that generates the world. And so that's an important difference. Yeah?
If somebody actually had an emptiness experience, the emptiness experience, and took the step off the precipice,
yes,
and then came back to tell themselves the tale, how could they then possibly have any attachment to self-image?
Well, that's the thing. The only attachment to self-image that they can have is one that arises out of habit. Okay, when this is originally, or initially, this is so fresh and powerful in your mind, it's so poignant, that there's a substantial period of time where you can't have that at all. But you're going, life goes on, the world goes on, and you're still subject to craving. And you still have the inherent sense of self. So what happens subsequently is the mind begins to slip back into its karmic patterns. You're not a Buddha yet. You haven't gotten past your karma. And you have karmic patterns of thinking and acting as though this ego self was real. And so, but it's transparent. It's only when you totally lose mindfulness and forget what you're doing that you will actually act as though it was real. Because you know it isn't, you can't forget that it isn't. You can't not know that that's real. But you can slip into kind of you can slip back into the dream again. And you will do that repeatedly. Yeah?
Do you, the stream enters, do they act out of that ever? Like, or is it something that would be a really quick little mental thing? Or would you actually have someone, for instance, like, forget, you know, lose their temper and, like, man, you know, like, say something, yeah, you know, like that? Like, to what extent is that slipping back?
That slipping back, it can happen for more than just a moment. And a person can slip into it for a period of time. What I would compare it to is you awoken from a bad dream. And you can always fall asleep again and the dream will start again. Mm-hmm. You know, but you'll wake up much more quickly. You know, you might have been really trapped in it for a long time. But, you know, and you can fall back into the dream several times. And that, I think, is That is at the very least the allegorical meaning of the term seven times return. You can slip back into the dream again. For how long and how deeply? When you start to experience enough suffering, you're going to wake up. And you're going to see where this suffering is coming from, and it's going to feel So, totally ridiculous. What am I doing? Well, the other thing that will wake you up is if you start acting on the basis of the dream, of the old pattern, of the attachment to the ego self, it's going to impact people around you, and they're going to suffer. And, you know, when you become aware of that suffering, when you've done and said something, and now the person you're looking at is in pain and crying, that wakes you up again. And then it's like, my God, what am I doing? How did I forget? How did I get here? You know, so it can last just that long. And you can slip back into it a number of times. You know, I interpret seven times returner to mean it can happen a few times, but not a huge number. That's what seven means. And you're slipping back into samsara. Yeah.
So then the practice of the 10 stages is really a good tool towards insight. Insight can happen at any time.
Yeah.
But these are things that we need to develop. So then the question from a mathematical perspective is, for an average person, how long does it take to master the 10 stages? And what is the daily practice they should be doing to do it as fast as possible?
Oh, there is an excellent question. I like that question. And various answers have been made available to the question of how long will it take. Well, actually, we could distinguish two between how long will it take to master the ten stages of samatha, and how long will it take to reach awakening. So let me clarify this. First of all, the Dalai Lama said in one of his books that any ordinary person should be able to master the ten stages. Or the stages of meditation. I made them 10. He was talking about assignments 9. In a year or less. And when I first started teaching, and I didn't really intend to teach in the beginning, but then I started to come in contact with these people that, you know, and when I realized how sincere they were, how dedicated they were to practicing, and how they weren't getting anywhere, then I felt like I'd better teach. And so when I started teaching, I was telling people, you know, hey, it'll take you a year or two. And I wasn't basing that on what the Dalai Lama said. I was basing that on what I thought was reasonable. And I found it very interesting later on to see that the Dalai Lama had also used that figure of a year. But now that I've been teaching for a while, I realized it's not a very good thing to put out a number like that. Because as soon as you have somebody that's been working at for a year or two, and they hear that, it's crushing. Okay? So, what I say is, you can achieve that in a few months. It's possible. I shouldn't say you can. There are people that can achieve that in a few months. And I think almost anybody can achieve that in a few years. And there are some people it might take longer for that. So that's kind of the feel that I have for it. Keeping in mind that it's all going to depend on the quality of your practice, the kind of person that you are. Think of it as a kind of karma you come to it with in the first place. And the circumstances in your life. And the circumstances in your life are going to have a big impact. Right? So actually, part of this practice should be looking at your life. And I mean, if you're serious about pursuing this path to its culmination, then you should have no hesitation to make the necessary changes in your life that are conducive to this. But these are all factors that are going to enter into it. Some people have a greater natural propensity, and so at least certain parts of the process become much easier to them. But I think I'll stick with, for most people, anywhere from a few months to several years. As to when I say that, that would be a person who probably, if I picture in my mind somebody who's, I picture some particular students in mind who are doing this over and succeeding over a course of months and years. Those are really interesting when I reflect on this. Okay. They usually, you know, you ask the question, how long should they practice every day? And the ones that are really making progress aren't the ones that I say, well, 45 minutes to an hour, and so they spend quite a while trying to get themselves up to a consistent 45 minutes a day. The ones that proceed quickly are the ones that are practicing an hour in the morning and an hour in an evening, and once a week they do several hours, and every time they have a chance to go on a retreat for a weekend or a week or 2 weeks, they do that. Those are the ones that progress very quickly. So that gives you an idea of the kind of time that it can take. As far as the culmination of the path, awakening, at the end of the Mahasatipatthana Sutra, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, the Buddha said that you should be able to achieve awakening in no more than 7 years. And then he says, in fact, no more than 7 months. And he said, well, no more than 7 weeks. He says, actually, you can do it in 7 days. So his opinion was, you know, it shouldn't take too long. And of course, if you read the sutras, it seems like he was right on. There's a lot of people that, you know, were able to, both lay people and bhikkhus, who were able to achieve this relatively quickly.
Yeah. What are the importance of the jhanas in reference to insight and how that works?
Okay. The jhanas basically are the insight practice that you find discussed in the sutras. And almost all of the references to meditation, samadhi, right concentration, samadhi, and so forth in the sutras are couched in terms of the jhanas. And they are an extremely powerful insight practice. You can practice jhanas from stage 6 of the 10 stages on. And at each of these stages, you can enter into a deeper and correspondingly more powerful set of jhanas. Now, the jhanas are numbered 1 to 4 form jhanas, and then there are the 4 formless jhanas. But from stage 6, you can enter into a very, very light form of jhana and progress from 1st to 2nd to 3rd to 4th. And from stage 7, you can enter into a still very light but somewhat deeper form of jhana and do the same thing. And this is true of each of the stages of samatha as you go. There's another interesting relationship between the stages of samatha and the jhanas, because stage 6 possesses the same defining characteristics as first jhana. And the characteristics of stage 7 as compared to the characteristics of stage 6 are comparable to the relationship between second and first jhana. And likewise, when you go to stage 8 and stage 9. So there is this, I was talking a little bit from rote and made a mistake there. Really, it's 7, 8, 9, and 10 that bear this correspondence to the jhanas 1, 2, 3, and 4.
And so that's where you get the insights. That, do you have to be in those jhanas to get the insights that give the precursor to the direct perception, or do you?
You do not. You don't have to be. You don't have to be in the jhanas. You don't have to do jhana practice at all to achieve the path of seeing. But it's a very powerful tool. Okay. Was that what you were asking?
Yeah. So then what is it a tool for?
It's a tool for achieving insight more quickly and achieving the culmination of insight more quickly. In terms of the samatha vipassana practice, there are a series of insights, and those insights can begin to arise right from the very beginning. And the farther you go along, the more of these insights you have. The more advanced insights into the three characteristics usually start to appear around stage 6, stage 7, stage 8. And they can appear very clearly. Not only that, the culminating insight of the realization of emptiness, or you know, whatever of the popular catchwords you want to use for it, that can happen at any time. But the farther along you are, the more likely it is to happen. You're increasing the probability. So, but if you examine the process, if it happens, you know, if you were to achieve the first path before you completed stage three, it would only be because, for one reason or another, either in your meditation practice or as a result of other practices that you were doing, that insights had been arising, because the insights prepared you for this. So think of it this way, that you undertake this course of practice, and the farther along you get, the more likelihood that the next time you sit down, that you're going to achieve awakening. So you just keep going. And then, if you reach one of the stages from which you can do jhana practice, and you're interested in doing jhana practice, then that's a very good way to enhance your practice. Actually, if you get to stage six and start doing this very light jhana practice, it will speed your progress through stages 7, 8, 9, 10. And the same thing is true as you go along. But also at the same time, the jhanas are, if you're doing them the right way, if you have powerful introspective awareness when you practice the jhanas, then you can achieve insights as a result of the jhana practice. Yeah?
So I'm trying to understand from your finger that's pointing at the moon, from the finger that I'm more used to pointing at the moon, in terms of the interconnection between interdependence and emptiness as being two different ways of viewing reality. That the view that interdependence and emptiness are separate is a delusion.
Yeah.
And that so viewing interdependence and viewing emptiness are two ways of viewing reality, similar to how you said mind and matter are two ways, not one is not better than the other, but they're two ways of viewing reality. Also thinking like the moon or the culmination of this path as Buddhahood, the description of a Buddha perceiving both interdependence and emptiness simultaneously, a Buddha uniquely has that experience. Other beings up to this evolution of the path would fluctuate back and forth. Mm-hmm. So when I hear you describe ultimate reality as separate or other, I'm having a hard time. Mm. I'm just having a hard time processing, like, how. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know how to explain it, but just what I'm more familiar with, like, through, like, teachings of Arya Nagarjuna and things like that, talking about emptiness in terms of interdependence, not mm-hmm. that emptiness is other, separate. So,
yeah. Okay, well, if I understood your question correctly, tell me if I didn't. Let me just make a clarification that there isn't a difference. There is no difference. You are empty. You are also a manifestation of ultimate reality. And samsara is empty. Samsara is nirvana. There's not a difference. There is no difference. And interdependence is a descriptive term that we can apply to relative reality in terms of how it really is, even though it doesn't appear to be that way. So we can use the term interdependence to talk about samsara in that way. And it is the true nature of reality that makes that description of as interdependence valid. Okay? Now, to say that ultimate reality is interdependence is, I mean, you could say that, but from a strictly logical perspective, it doesn't really make sense, because you can't have some things that are interdependent unless you've got separate things. And ultimate reality doesn't consist of separate things. So, you see what I'm saying? There's a sense in which you could say emptiness, ultimate reality, suchness, is interdependence. And you'd be telling the truth. But there's also a sense in which it's total nonsense, because the literal meaning of interdependence is something that could not actually apply to ultimate reality. Does that get to it?
It does. I think I'm thinking of the descriptions of emptiness as being the absence of independent existence of something. So that it's not a free-floating emptiness out there. It's the emptiness of something. I mean, to have emptiness without an appearance. Like the emptiness of emptiness, that it's not like the free-floating emptiness out there, that it's, I'm trying to think of how, if we're expanding our awareness so that the separate minds that we're constructing around different things, always trying to make these holes, out of the parts, that's what we're constantly doing. If we expanded our awareness to include everything, then that's still an appearance. So if you're looking at the emptiness of everything, is that not still dependent upon an awareness of everything?
If you're looking at the emptiness of everything, it's still dependent upon appearances, yes. Because everything is only an appearance. Yeah.
But doesn't that make emptiness dependent on that? I mean, that it's not other self-existent out there separate. It seems like we're trying to get away from the desire, or I'm finding lack of the right words to use, but the part of the problem is that we're conceptualizing things as separate. So how can a conceptualization of emptiness as other and separate be the combination of what we want to be, removing the separateness, if we're looking at ultimate reality as something other and separate?
Okay, I think what you're doing is you're confronting the limitations of logic and conceptualization. You cannot conceptualize this in a way that is truly accurate. You can conceptualize it and talk about it in a lot of different ways, which might for a specific purpose be useful, but they're none of them going to be accurate. And if you look at them in a slightly different way than the way they're useful, you find they're internally contradictory and meaningless. And that's just the nature of the limitations of mind and logic and conceptualization. In terms of emptiness, I think we need to wrap this up. But just in terms of emptiness, I want to point out something to you. The Buddha himself, in his original teaching, taught both the emptiness of phenomena, but the emptiness of the self. But he put all of his emphasis on the emptiness of self, which sometimes people have said, well, he spoke only of the emptiness of self. But it's not true. He did speak of the emptiness of phenomena. But he put all the emphasis on emptiness of self for a very good reason. That if you realize the emptiness of phenomena, but remain attached to the reality of self, this puts you into that solipsistic trap. It's a very lonely place, and from that place, it would be quite easy for you to do things. Being in that place is going to be harmful to you, but it would be quite easy from that place to do things that are harmful to other people. And at the very least, because of this view of others as only being projection of your mind, you are denying other sentient beings the respect that they deserve, and you are caught in an illusion. It is easier to understand the emptiness of other, the emptiness of phenomena, than it is the emptiness of self. And so you can use understanding the emptiness of phenomena to help you understand the emptiness of self. But the definition of a stream enterer is someone who has realized the emptiness of self. This is key. This is a very key thing. Now there's another thing too, that you can become attached to emptiness. And Arya Nagarjuna and Bodhidharma and a whole lot of other people along the way have repeated over and over again. When you believe, if you're attached to the reality of phenomenon, you can realize emptiness. If you're attached to the reality of self, you can realize emptiness. But when you become attached to emptiness, there's no hope.
Yeah. true.
It leads to a kind of nihilism, and it is one of the deadly perils along the way. So beware of it. And okay, just.
A practical question. I'm sorry. You can say talk to someone else about it later, because there's only one more night. But I keep having the most intense. I won't call them nightmares, but like I've been waking up. My mind's been very nice during the day, and then at night it's like all hell breaks loose, and I've been having dreams of like with the five senses, and it's like I haven't slept. I've been awake in these like crazy worlds. And like waking up a lot, and I'm just curious if you have any, if there's a reason why that happens. I'm not so used to that. I'm not sure you have crazy dreams, but and how you can go to sleep and kind of tell them like it's okay, you don't have to like.
I'll just give you a quick and simple answer to that. It's normal. It comes and goes. Sometimes it's more so than others. The other thing that will happen, especially in a retreat situation, or particularly in a retreat situation, you get a week or two into a retreat situation and you really don't need more than 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night. Not only that, you find that you're meditating all the time you're asleep. You have a dream and you know you're having a dream. The amazing thing is you'll come to a place where you're in deep sleep, not having a dream, and you'll know you're in deep sleep. It's kind of amazing. But yeah, the things that happen after you go to bed and before the first set in the morning, they can be pretty, pretty different. That's normal. Don't worry about it. Okay? I think we need to cut it off there. You have 8 minutes before the next bell rings, which gives you 13 minutes for anybody who's going to come sit to come get settled. So let's go do your thing. See you this evening.